From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. It's Friday, April 29th. I'm Marco Werman. Prince William and Kate Middleton got hitched, and royal watchers came from all over for the London nuptials.
I think it's like a fairy tale, isn't it? It's something like to celebrate.
One New York bride planned to get up early to watch the wedding.
I meant to, actually, but I didn't want to look too tired for my own. I'm still looking for my invitation, though.
Also, fracking comes to a Polish village.
It was nighttime, but it was actually as bright as if it was daytime, and we were just, oh my God, what's this?
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, assembling the country's resuscitation experts to save more lives from sudden cardiac arrest. Learn more at heartrescueproject.com. Medtronic, innovating for life. And by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Well, they've done it. Prince William and Kate Middleton tied the knot today, and their wedding captivated millions of TV viewers all around the globe.
Kate Middleton on the hunt from her father.
For as much as William and Catherine
puisque William et Catherine ont consenti à s'unir en saint mariage,
Kate Middleton is now Duchess of Cambridge.
Broadcasts of the royal wedding today is heard by some of the millions of viewers who tuned in worldwide. In Accra, Ghana, one woman watched with some friends at a beauty parlor.
It's about tradition and the ceremony. You know, I like wedding ceremonies. I enjoy singing the hymns, and I'm very happy.
It's just nice to share a happy moment.
The thoughts of one woman who witnessed the royal wedding. It was a much different for those in London today. The World's Laura Lynch was just outside Buckingham Palace this morning. Laura, you're a commoner, but it sounds like a bit of royalty rubbed off on just about everyone today, including you. But these are such difficult economic times for so many in Britain. Are people there really in the mood to be more accepting of a royal family and this really lavish display of wealth that goes with it?
Well, if you'd been where I was today, the answer would pretty certainly be yes. The people down there were really having a good time, and there were huge crowds out there today, ready to celebrate the royal family, ready to celebrate being British. And it was an overwhelmingly British crowd down there today. And yes, the debate exists about whether this is the right time to be spending this kind of money on this kind of a spectacle. But I think for most people today, it was an opportunity to put aside the worries about the economy, the complaints about whether this is a right time to spend money, and just really have a good time and relax. And thank goodness the sun came out, because I think it made everybody feel a little bit better.
What extent, though, was today, do you think, a turning point for Britain's royals? Because it hasn't been an easy road the last 15 years or so.
This was a very important turning point for the royal family, and they knew it. They knew that since the death of Diana, Princess of Wales, in 1997, that they had to turn things around, that they really did need to mount a fight back to become relevant, to become legitimate in the eyes of the world and of course, in the eyes of the majority of Britons. And so the way this wedding has been planned, the way the details have been released slowly over time, the way it was all presented today was all about recapturing that very British sense of having a royal family that matters.
And what a vision.
It's exquisite.
It was the ultimate example of the royal family's triumph in controlling every detail of the day. As Kate Middleton stepped onto the red carpet outside Westminster Abbey, her dress was revealed. Created by a British designer, it was only part of a day that will be billed as displaying the epitome of Britishness. The bride's slow procession down the long, long aisle to her waiting prince was accompanied by a traditional British hymn. With 1,900 guests inside the Abbey and hundreds of thousands more listening on loudspeakers outside on the streets nearby, the couple proclaimed their vows.
I, William Arthur Philip Louis.
I, William Arthur Philip Louis.
Take thee, Catherine Elizabeth.
Take thee, Catherine Elizabeth.
To my wedded wife.
To my wedded wife.
I, Catherine Elizabeth.
I, Catherine Elizabeth.
Take thee, William Arthur Philip Louis.
Take thee, William Arthur Philip Louis.
To my wedded husband.
To my wedded husband.
When they emerged soon after as a married couple, they also emerged as the newest standard bearers for the House of Windsor, a family stained by scandal and tragedy, now looking to its youngest generation to restate its claim to relevance and legitimacy. The efforts seem to pay off for people like Ralph Nuraki, who traveled from Baltimore to be part of the day.
We've come from a monarchy, you know, even though we have a totally different way of life over there. Over here, they've maintained that tradition, and it's a beautiful one, I think.
There are many in Britain who grumble about the cost or the meaninglessness of a monarchy in the modern age. But when the couple kissed on the palace balcony, Aaron Pankow, Kelsey Gallagher, and Lisa Hank felt a little bit of magic.
Oh, we loved it. So exciting.
We've been here since 4 a.m., I think.
Yeah.
And what was the best part as far as your concerned?
When they came out on the balcony.
Yeah, the kiss was really sweet.
The kiss was quicker than we thought, but it was still such an experience to see it live.
The crowd may have been liberally laced with Americans, but London is an international city. And the British royal family, more than any other, attracts an international crowd. Joyce Huey is from Taiwan.
I think it's like a fairy tale, isn't it? So, it's something like to celebrate. And I'm very happy I made it today, too.
If you needed to see success in marketing an image globally, look no further than Neil Medina of the Philippines, decked out in a garish Union Jack suit, accompanied by a friend wearing a hat featuring Big Ben that he designed. Medina says today's ceremonies put Britain back on top.
The envy of the world. We don't have a royalty in the Philippines. Imelda Marcos wanted to be the queen. Only the queen of 3,000 shoes she was.
Medina's right. Imelda Marcos may have yearned to wear a crown, but the shoe collection was as close as she got. As British planes roared overhead, the crowd cheered and the royal family beamed. For them, this was much more than a wedding. It was also the right moment to try to move beyond a troubled past.
The World's Laura Lynch in London back with us now. Laura, were you wearing a hat?
I was wearing headphones, Marco.
You can fit headphones under a hat if it's the right hat.
I tried to put flowers in, but it just didn't work.
The World's Laura Lynch in London, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
William and Kate were not, of course, the only people getting hitched today. The World's Alex Galifant met some of the other couples tying the knot today in downtown Manhattan.
First up, Lauren Goodman and her new husband, Nathan Tyler. Now, Lauren didn't watch this morning's royal nuptials.
I meant to, actually, but I didn't want to look too tired for my own. Vanity first.
We're very excited. We're also very excited for them, too.
I'm still looking for my invitation, though.
They could come here anytime.
Heading in for their ceremony, Candy Kugel and her husband-to-be, Chuck Honeywell. Another marriage for love, among other things.
My health insurance runs out at the end of April. But 65 days ago, I was watching the Today Show and found out it was also their wedding day. So I've been reminded every day since how many days for the countdown.
And finally, there was Joel Brown and his new bride, Montserrat Margalef. Today, at least, they were going by another title.
We're the Bronx Royals. Montserrat has transformed from Newburgh to the Bronx. What's your new zip code, babe?
10475.
She's a Yankee fan, I'm a Mets fan. But we love each other.
Oh, and I forgot, they had their little dog, Mickey, with them, too.
There's Mickey right there.
A little Yorkie.
Unlike most of the people I met, Montserrat Margalef did wake up early to see William and Kate get married.
And it was fun to watch. It was like a getting ready kind of movie, you know?
A warm-up for the main event, one that didn't need all the horses and parades and flypasts.
We wish the best to them, but there's nothing like New York.
Yes.
We have the entire city waiting for us, and we're going to travel it today, and for the next 20, 30 years.
Yes.
That's Joel Brown and Montserrat Margalef celebrating their wedding in New York City today. For The World, I'm Alex Galifant.
You can see pictures of those happy couples at theworld.org. Now, on to the next mega event in Europe. It's not a wedding, royal or otherwise. It's the beatification ceremony for the late Pope John Paul II. It takes place Sunday at the Vatican. A million pilgrims are gathering in Rome to attend the ceremony. Megan Williams has more.
When John Paul II died 6 years ago, thousands gathered in St. Peter's Square chanting Santo Subito, sainthood now. While the Vatican didn't grant John Paul sainthood right away, it did put the late Pope on the fast track. Current Pope Benedict XVI waived the usual 5-year waiting period after death before the sainthood cause can be launched. Then in January, the Vatican approved as a miracle the claim by a French nun that she was cured of Parkinson's through prayer to John Paul. It also announced the beatification date, May 1st, at the time less than 4 months away. The speed with which the Vatican moved John Paul towards sainthood is a result of the saint-making machine that the former Pope himself set in motion.
John Paul set the precedent for expediting the sainthood process.
Vatican expert Francis X. Rocca cites Mother Teresa's beatification just a few years after her death. But there were many more new saints as well.
John Paul beatified and canonized many, 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 many more people than hundreds of years of his predecessors put together. He wanted to use sainthood and beatification as a method of evangelization. Saints are models of virtue, so the more saints you have, the more models you offer people.
Rocca says new saints also help highlight Catholic identity. For a church with dwindling worldwide attendance and a long series of sexual abuse scandals, beatifications and canonizations also play an ever more important role in promoting a positive image of Catholicism. They draw positive media attention, not to mention huge crowds. Yet, with the beatification date announced so soon after the Vatican-approved miracle, those crowds won't be nearly as big as initially expected.
To be honest, 100%, we were extremely surprised and disappointed by the date that was then announced.
Roberta Zito is a manager of Rome's oldest tour agency, Corani Tours. She says when the beatification announcement was made in January, the city of Rome predicted up to 3 million tourists. Travel agencies rushed to book blocks of hotel rooms, only to have to give a lot of them back. Zito says the Vatican didn't give people enough time to plan.
2003, we did the beatification of Mother Teresa of Calcutta, but we had a good 10 months to prepare for that. Something like John Paul II, which was far bigger in many aspects, has been a disappointment for us, a huge disappointment.
There'll still likely be about 1 million Catholics, many from John Paul's homeland of Poland, coming to Rome, but not nearly the numbers the city or the Vatican were hoping for. For The World, I'm Megan Williams in Rome.
Still to come on the program, the Egyptian revolution foretold great changes in policy there. Now we're seeing evidence of that in Gaza. That's on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, now recruiting runners who benefit from medical technology to participate in Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon events. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes. And by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The hunt for cheap energy has spurred a technological revolution recently. It's a revolution that often comes with steep environmental costs, though. Think deep water offshore drilling and mountaintop coal removal. The latest breakthrough technology is known as fracking. It's a way of extracting hard-to-get natural gas. Gas has long been considered a cleaner alternative to oil and coal, but fracking has raised environmental concerns in many nations, including the U.S., France, and South Africa. Now fracking is coming to Poland, and as Dave McGuire reports, so far, local reaction has been muted.
This is our neighbor's house. They are already building. Our house is going to be a little bit closer.
For years, it's been the dream of Maya and her husband Maciej to build a house and raise their daughter in the quiet Polish village of Niestkowo. But during a recent visit to the town, they found that quiet suddenly disrupted.
We were passing by and we saw a huge metal, I don't know how you call it, mast, with plenty of lights on it. It was nighttime, but it was actually as bright as if it was daytime. And we were just, oh my God, what's this?
It turned out it was a new test well for shale gas, the latest to pop up here in the north of Poland near the Baltic Sea. The couple had heard about shale gas exploration, but they had no idea it was coming so close to their land.
Now we have a question. Should we just, you know, stop planning and change completely our life? And we don't know. We are just terrified.
Maya doesn't want to give her last name. She's worried about drawing the attention of what she calls the big money interests involved. But her concern about shale gas puts her in the minority here in Poland. Millions of Poles use gas for cooking and heating, but virtually all of it now comes from Russia. And after centuries of domination by their giant neighbor to the east, that's a big problem for many Poles.
Energia, bezpieczeństwo energetyczne, dywersyfikacja źródeł energii.
That's Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk speaking recently in Warsaw.
Chyba bez większego ryzyka można powiedzieć.
The search for our own domestic energy sources must be a priority, Tusk said. We are determined to make shale gas in Poland become a reality. The Prime Minister didn't specifically mention Russia when talking about developing Poland's own gas supply, and few Polish politicians will. But people in the gas industry here certainly do.
Russia is not a good supplier based upon their past history of forcing their hand on countries and governments.
John Bugenhagen is with San Leon Energy. He says tapping Poland's large shale gas reserves could end Russia's gas monopoly, and that would change the regional balance of power. The key, Bugenhagen says, is a new technology. Shale gas is trapped in impermeable rock, and until recently it was too expensive to get it out. But that changed when Americans developed what's called hydraulic fracturing, or fracking.
You use pressure, and then you typically would use some type of proppant, which can be very small, rounded glass balls, and you'll use a fluid, so a lot of fracks use water. And with pressure, you shove that water and this proppant into the subsurface, cracking the rock.
That allows the gas to seep out and be sucked up. Fracking has made a lot of new gas available in North America, but it's not without its critics.
Six states have documented over 1,000 incidents of groundwater contamination.
It bubbles and hisses when it comes out. I won't drink it.
The 2010 film Gasland documented what it says are the environmental consequences of fracking. It's part of a growing wave of scrutiny of the practice. Among other problems, critics say fracking can contaminate groundwater. The backlash in the U.S. has spread abroad as well, most recently to France, where the government might cancel shale gas exploration because of environmental concerns. But here in Poland, there's been barely a peep, even at Greenpeace. Julia Michalak runs climate and energy programs for Greenpeace Poland. She says her group is still investigating fracking.
And if one day we decide that this is one of the main environmental problems in Poland, we'll definitely act.
Michalak says that right now, Poland has more pressing energy problems.
The biggest concern is a coal-based economy, as coal covers more than 90% of Polish energy needs.
For now, Greenpeace sees shale gas as a possible transition fuel on the way to a future powered by renewable energy. And just as there's no concerted environmental campaign against shale gas here, there are also very few legal obstacles.
There is no special environmental law concerning shale gas. And in fact,
I don't see any need for that.
That's Piotr Otowski of the Polish Environment Ministry. He says the government already requires every big new project to have an environmental impact assessment. Like those other projects, he says, the government will consider fracking proposals on a case-by-case basis. And John Buggenhagen of San Leon Energy says his company's projects will stand up to such scrutiny. Shale gas drillers in the U.S. say concerns about groundwater contamination there are unfounded. And Buggenhagen says that if the water issue comes up in Poland, the industry here is also ready with a response.
If the groundwater aquifers at 200 meters or even 1,000 meters, the shale gas here in Poland is anywhere between 2,500 and over 4,000 meters. So you've got shallow water and deep gas. So in my opinion, there's no risk of tainting the sweet water deposits.
Buggenhagen acknowledges that there would be big changes on the surface. But he says San Leon will work with local communities to make sure that both parties benefit. Back in Nieskowo, some of Maja and Maciej's future neighbors are eager to see some of those benefits. I have nothing against it, this woman says, because it's quite far from where I live, and maybe there will be jobs. But Mayor Bogdan Jabinski doubts his village would see any benefit. And he fears the potential costs. He says, just look at what happened in Japan with their nuclear power. It was supposed to be incredibly safe, but it turned out that it isn't. And the same can be said for shale gas. We've been told it's okay, but there's no guarantee that our environment won't be harmed. For now, gas companies here are only drilling test wells. Any actual production could still be years away. Plenty of time for the debate over fracking to play out around the world and here in Poland. For The World, this is Dave McGuire, Nieskowo, Poland.
Just across the Baltic Sea from Poland, folks in Denmark are also looking at an alternative energy source, ethanol. Ethanol is usually made from food crops like corn or soybeans, but the Danish want to make biofuels from waste, agricultural waste, and even household garbage. Can trash fuel our future? We'll find out in the latest edition of our weekly technology podcast. Go to theworld.org/science to find out how to subscribe. And while you're there, be sure to check out our other audio offerings. We've got weekly podcasts on everything from language to science, from history to foreign policy. And there's more to The World than what you hear on the radio. Our weekly podcasts contain a lot of stories you won't hear on air. So check it out at theworld.org/podcasts. News stories of the day are next here on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, Egypt plans to open a key border crossing with the Palestinian Gaza Strip. And later, songs from England, but not for the royal couple.
I'm not flag-wavingly against the monarchy or the royal wedding. A bunch of rich people I don't know got married last weekend as well, and I wasn't wearing a t-shirt for that either. So good luck to them.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, assembling the country's resuscitation experts to save more lives from sudden cardiac arrest. Learn more at heartrescueproject.com. Medtronic, innovating for life. And by Cargill, working with customers around the world to connect ideas to opportunities across food, agriculture, finance, and industry. Information at cargill.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Egypt's government raised some eyebrows today by announcing plans to reopen the Rafah border crossing with the Gaza Strip. The crossing was kept shut by the government of former President Hosni Mubarak. In an interview with Al Jazeera, the current Egyptian foreign minister condemned the blockade of the Palestinian territory and said preparations to end it are already underway. The World's Middle East correspondent Matthew Bell has covered the political transformation in Egypt, and he joins us from Jerusalem. Matthew, what's the thinking in Cairo here?
Egypt says that it wants to open the border at Rafah to relieve the suffering that the blockade has brought on the Palestinian people. That has a lot to do with overturning a policy from the Mubarak era that's been deeply, deeply unpopular with the Egyptian public. Mubarak was no friend of Hamas in Gaza. Their spiritual forefathers came from Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood. Mubarak's government was an active player in the blockade of Gaza, and that goes back to 2006 when Palestinian militants kidnapped the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, who's been held ever since. To put this in context, I talked with Stephen Cook, who's an expert on Middle East politics at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he says that the plan to open the border was not surprising. It's about Egypt's new rulers making a clean break with the Mubarak era by changing the way that they deal with Israel.
The Egyptians want to normalize their relations. The interim foreign minister, Nabil Al Arabi, talked about a normal relationship with Israel, not a strategic relationship. And there's a broad sense that at least the way Mubarak defined Egyptian national interests was too close to Israel's security concerns and Israel's own interests, and that Egypt itself is a powerful country, is an important country, and that its interests are different.
Cook went on to say, Marco, that he doesn't think Egypt's military leaders or the leading contenders for the Egyptian presidency would go so far as to tear up Egypt's peace treaty with Israel or even scrap the Camp David agreement. But there is a sense among experts I've talked with that Egypt's foreign policy toward Israel and toward the United States will change fundamentally.
So what's been the reaction from Israel, where there's got to be concern about what an open border with Egypt would mean for the Islamist group Hamas, which controls Gaza, and not to mention kind of a shift away from Israeli concerns back to Egyptian concerns?
The Israelis have been very, very careful about the way they have talked in public about Egypt, and that is ever since the turmoil began back in January. But there's clearly concern in Israel about what's happening there. Israel's worried that an open border between Egypt and Gaza would make it easier for Palestinian militants there to get a hold of weapons. At the same time, Egypt is upgrading its relationship with Hamas in Gaza. Just this week, the Egyptians brokered a reconciliation agreement between the main Palestinian factions, Fatah and Hamas. Egypt is also improving its diplomatic ties with Iran. None of this, Marco, it will come as no surprise to you, is good news from the perspective of Israel's government.
The World's Matthew Bell speaking with us from Jerusalem. Thanks so much, Matthew.
Thank you, Marco.
Officials in Morocco are investigating yesterday's bombing in Marrakesh. 15 people were killed, most of them foreign tourists. Today, officials said the blast was probably set off by remote control. It's the first major terrorist attack in Morocco since 2003, when suicide bombers killed 45 people in Casablanca. In recent years, the Kingdom of Morocco has been considered a bulwark against Al-Qaeda as the terrorist network makes inroads into North Africa. The World's Jerry Haddon reports.
Yesterday's blast destroyed the Argana Cafe, a magnet for foreign vacationers, just off the main Jemaa al-Fna Square in the heart of Marrakesh. Hugo Shoram Jones owns a nearby hotel. He says he got to the scene minutes after hearing a huge explosion.
The first floor, the whole first floor of this very popular tourist cafe has been sort of totally flattened, and we saw a number of limp, lifeless bodies being picked up by sort of brave waiters and no doubt members of the public as well.
As authorities scrambled to save the wounded, Moroccans were hoping it was an accident, perhaps a gas explosion. But Morocco's communications minister, Khalid Nassiri, now says the government believes terrorists were behind the explosion.
Morocco is always under threat, like all other democracies in the region. The terrorist threat is always there. We did at one stage think this was an accident, but after a few hours we realized we were dealing with a criminal act. And given that this criminal act targeted civilians and innocent people in a public place, we understood it was a terrorist act.
So far, no group has claimed responsibility, but Nabila Ramdani, a specialist in the Middle East and North Africa, says she, like the government, suspects Al-Qaeda. If that's the case, she says, it's a blow to the West as well as to Morocco.
What is for sure is that the government of Morocco has worked extremely hard over the years since, in fact, the 9/11 terrorist attacks. The Moroccan government has worked in partnership with the Americans in the so-called War on Terror. And because Morocco was one of the few Arab countries which has committed fully to the War on Terror, Al-Qaeda has had a vendetta against Morocco, precisely because the Moroccan government has also handed over Al-Qaeda suspects to the Americans over the year. So there are frequent onslaughts against terrorist cells by the government of Morocco.
In the last decade, Morocco has broken up some 70 alleged terrorist cells, and it has put thousands of suspects in jail. But Ramdani says the threat will likely continue until Morocco can offer a future for its poor young citizens.
I think that, you know, one has to bear in mind that behind the tourist myth of palm trees, camels and lovely medinas, there's also huge poverty in Morocco and an awful lot of human rights abuses, and young people are suffering the most from that.
Yesterday's attack could be a setback in more than just the war on terror. The country's tentative moves towards greater democracy could be threatened too, say activists who've been marching en masse in recent weeks. Moroccan journalist Ali Al-Merabet says he fears the bombing will give Moroccan King Mohammed VI a pretext to halt democratic reforms in the name of security.
The regime is going to buy time now. If they haven't started already, state security forces are going to launch a wave of new arrests. Morocco is a police state. There will be thousands. And when they arrest you, it's done illegally, and you're taken to prison and tortured.
But today, Morocco's communications minister sought to assure Moroccans that the reforms the king has announced will move forward. One of those reforms has been to release hundreds of political prisoners. If the king has those same suspects swept up again, the earlier gesture would be lost. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon.
Today's GeoQuiz focuses on northwestern Europe. The country we want you to name is on an island, Europe's third largest. Its booming economy was once referred to as a roaring tiger. Today's quiz totem is a very different animal, though, the greyhound. Greyhound breeding and racing are big in this country, and soon exporting greyhounds to China may also be a lucrative business. So what is this island's name? You only have a few seconds to come up with the answer. And time's up. The European country we were looking for is Ireland. Congrats, by the way, to those of you who played our texting game today and got the answer right. Some of our winners are Jared from Bethesda, Maryland, Alicia from Des Moines, Iowa, and Chris from Richland, Washington. Now, about those greyhounds. Marion Fitzgibbon is director of the Limerick Animal Welfare Group in Ireland. The group is protesting against a proposed deal that would allow the Irish Greyhound Board to export their dogs to China for racing and breeding there.
Well, it's a very bad idea from the point of view of the greyhounds because there are no animal rights laws pertaining in China at the present time. Indeed, there are very little human rights pertaining there. So if the greyhounds go to China, we will have absolutely no say in how they are treated and how they will be eventually euthanized at the end of their racing career. So their future would be very uncertain and probably they would meet a brutal end.
Well, I can certainly understand your concern, but earlier today we asked Brian Purcell, a spokesman for the Irish Greyhound Board, about how China will care for these dogs his organization is sending there. Let's hear what he had to say.
All welfare, all feeding, all veterinary, and all racing parts of their career will be taken care of by Irish employees of the Irish Greyhound Board. And when they are finished their racing careers, some will be kept on for breeding purposes, and the rest will be brought back to Europe, where we have a substantial rehoming and adopting program throughout the European continent.
So essentially, from what Brian Purcell is saying there, it sounds like there is no chance that the dogs could be sold to market in China for meat or anything else. That would be the most extreme example of what could happen to them.
We would not believe his statement at all. At the moment, we have several thousand greyhounds in Ireland each year that are surplus to requirements of the greyhound industry, and they can only manage to home some hundreds of those every year in Europe. They will have five stadia operating in China with a couple of thousand dogs in each stadia, and they think they can bring several thousand dogs back into Europe to rehome them. That's not realistic, and even if they do have people over there, eventually the Chinese will take over this breeding program themselves and will manage the Irish dogs themselves.
Right, and the Irish Greyhound Board stands to make a lot of money from this, but it sounds like you don't really trust what they have to say. I mean, it's worth pointing out that in Ireland, greyhound breeding is overseen by the Department of Agriculture, and that makes it quite different from the United States, where a lot of dog racing is private, but with state regulation that varies between a total ban on dog racing in some states to minimal regulation in other states. So, I mean, Ireland has strong guidelines in place to protect the dogs.
Ireland is hoping to introduce new guidelines shortly on the welfare of greyhounds, but up to this point in time, they've had a lot of regulations, but very little welfare regulations. It's all about business and money and gross overbreeding of the greyhound in Ireland. We had probably 24,000 puppies registered again this year, and the industry cannot possibly assimilate this many young pups. The UK greyhound industry is in decline and the large tracks are closing in Britain. There is no market for these dogs, so this is why they look to China for a new market. We already send Irish dogs to Pakistan and nobody has any idea what happens to them there. It's a small number of dogs going to Pakistan, but if China is, it'll be a huge number.
Marion Fitzgibbon, the director of the Limerick Animal Welfare Group in Ireland, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
The royal wedding's over, and some say the big job now for William and Kate is to produce heirs. Kate Middleton is a commoner. She doesn't come from British royal or noble stock. I guess that means an expansion of the gene pool now. In the past, royal families have tended to be, and there's no other way of saying this, they've tended to be inbred, with all the hazards associated with inbreeding. Dr. Alan Rushton specializes in medical genetics and has written several books on the topic, including Royal Maladies, Inherited Diseases in the Royal House of Europe. He joins us from his offices in Flemington, New Jersey. Dr. Rushton, fact-check my statement for me. Has inbreeding affected the British royal family in the past, leading to, as it does, to diseases, most notably hemophilia? Or is that notion of royal inbreeding and disease a myth?
It certainly is true. There's evidence of several different hereditary diseases that have been transmitted through successive generations of the British royals, and certainly inbreeding has contributed to that.
And was hemophilia a result of inbreeding?
The best evidence we have is that hemophilia resulted from a mutation, a sudden change in a gene affecting clotting factors in Edward, Duke of Kent, who was the father of Queen Victoria. She inherited the mutated gene but had no symptoms herself, as only males are affected. Then she went on to have eight children, and one son, Prince Leopold, actually had the bleeding disorder, hemophilia, and two daughters were unaffected carriers and then passed it on to male children in the subsequent generations.
Queen Victoria was apparently eager to get fresh blood into her family, and some of her descendants married into other royal families of Europe. Wouldn't that, though, just spread hemophilia further across Europe?
That is correct. Prince Albert and Queen Victoria encouraged their own children to marry into the royal houses of Europe for political purposes, to stabilize the relations between Britain and Russia and Germany and Spain. But unfortunately, that did pass the hemophilia gene into the royal houses in Russia, several German states, and eventually Spain as well.
Now, hemophilia wasn't the only royal disease in Britain. There is porphyria, a disease that's thought to have led to King George III's madness and portrayed some time ago in the film The Madness of King George. Tell us what porphyria is and how it entered the royal family.
Porphyria is an interesting disease. It's a neurologic and skin disease. There are about seven different kinds of inherited porphyria. The type that seems to be present in the British royal family is called variegate porphyria, and produces symptoms of sudden attacks of severe abdominal pain, skin rashes on the arms and the face, palpitations in the chest, fevers, thought disorders, seizures, and even coma. And it can go on for weeks at a time before gradually improving. In between these episodes, individuals are perfectly healthy, and they seem to be brought on by certain environmental factors like excessive alcohol use, Heavy metals are another factor, too, like lead and arsenic. In historical times, lead was used in a lot of foods and medicines, and arsenic, for example, is used to whiten the wigs that were worn in royal households.
Mm.
And individuals who had porphyria would have these unfortunate attacks, which could put a person out of commission for weeks at a time.
Are hemophilia and porphyria still present in the British royal family today?
The best evidence we have is no. Most recent individual in the royal family with porphyria, as far as we know, was Elizabeth II's cousin named Prince William. He died in a plane crash over 30 years ago. He had no children. We assume that all the current royals have been tested. None of this health information has been made public, but they appear to be reasonably healthy people and don't have any evidence of porphyria as far as we know.
Dr. Alan Rushton, author of Royal Maladies, joining us from his offices at the Hunterdon Medical Center in Flemington, New Jersey. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Just ahead, one musician who's not on the royal bandwagon on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. You heard our coverage earlier of the royal wedding. Well, we also end our program with music from England, but these are not songs to accompany the royal nuptials. Not at all.
Amy worked in a bar in Exeter. I went back to her house and I slept beside her. She woke up screaming in the middle of the night, terrified of her own insides. Dreams of pirates.
This is the music of Frank Turner. And this is also Frank Turner.
Many years back when these old oaks were young, not long after the Northmen had come, a lone evil deed was done in the dark of the New Forest, in the dark of the New Forest. From the shores of Normandy King William came, to Albion fair King Harold to slay. With greed in his heart and a scurrilous claim, he took the land for his own. He took the land for his own.
Frank Turner has just begun a tour of North America. Some describe his music as folk punk, others folk rock. Pace magazine calls him the new Joe Strummer, the former and late great leader of The Clash. And Mr. Turner, the song we're hearing right now, this a cappella number, it's called English Curse. Tell us, what is that low and evil deed that was done in the dark of the New Forest?
Well, that was a tune. Because I'm incredibly cool and trendy and hip, I was reading some books about folklore in the Hampshire area, which is where I'm from in the UK. And the King William II was killed in a hunting accident around there. But there's a local story that it was because his father stole some locals' land for royal hunting grounds, and a curse was placed on him. And it was said that his son would die in return. Retaliation for his theft. And I read it and I thought, you know what, that needs to become a song. So we went for it.
It's epic. Do you do a lot of reading of English history, ancient, medieval?
I do, yeah. I'm a bit of a history geek, actually. That's my kind of other passion outside of music, which is one of the reasons I kind of got into folk music in a way, because it's kind of like history music.
Your own story, Frank Turner, is one of hard labor, it seems. Lead singer for the hardcore band Million Dead a few years back, then off on your own as a solo artist who really never took no for an answer, just putting in the miles on the road in the UK, playing clubs, pubs, and living rooms. Are you working class or just a hardworking musician?
I'm a hardworking musician. I'm from my parents are quite staunchly middle class in my background, but I don't know. The bands I grew up idolizing were the bands that worked hard, like Black Flag or The Clash, or even stuff like, you know, B.B. King and the old kind of jazz players, you know, people who just, for them, being a musician was a functional thing. It meant playing every single day rather than kind of, you know, doing one tour a year and spending the rest of the year kind of lying on chaise longues, being fed grapes by supermodels while contemplating art. That's just never like really sort of... Well, it sounds like fun, but that's not really for me. I'd rather be out there actually playing, because that's why I want to be a musician, because I like playing music, you know. So, and yeah, I guess my plan so far has been to try and just essentially kind of wear down the world's resistance by playing all the time everywhere, and it's going quite well.
Listening to this new recording of yours, England Keep My Bones, it does sound like the musical standard of the British working class, and it occurred to me with this little wedding today in London that with your historical perspective and working class focus, what this wedding means to you and similarly minded Brits. I mean, from here, all we've been hearing about is how the wedding of Kate and William has brought out the sentimental side in everyone there. Are you caught up in it?
My sentimental side is stubbornly and staunchly refusing to come out. I find it very hard to care. You know, a bunch of rich people I don't know got married last weekend as well, and I wasn't wearing a T-shirt for that either. So, you know, it's just sort of not really important to me. I mean, I don't have any sort of massively burning and pressing desire to kind of storm the palace and chop off everybody's heads. But I just, you know, good luck to him.
Basically. That might put you on a no-fly list.
That might, oh, yeah, damn. Except I said I didn't want to chop off their heads. I don't want to chop off anybody's head. Well, not really. No, you know what? This is where we should talk about something else.
All right, let's talk about another monarchy. I see that you were born in Bahrain, even though you're British.
I was, yeah.
It's another monarchy, but proving way more problematic than Britain's monarchy lately. Do you have any special insight on what's going on in Bahrain, since you are, in a way, a native son?
See, I left Bahrain when I was about 6 months old, so my memories are a little hazy.
That's okay. We'll still consider you an expert.
Okay, cool. Excellent. Good. Yeah, I mean, you know, the whole Arab Spring thing's been pretty interesting. I was miffed just because I think they burned down the hospital I was born in the other day. Not generally something I'm a massive fan of, really, if I had to say that kind of behavior. But yeah, I was a little miffed. I was hoping that one day maybe I'd go back and pay a visit to that hospital, but it is now no longer there.
Now, on your new CD, there's this song, Glory Hallelujah. I doubt you're going to hear this tune much today in England, after all. Yours is the land of God Save the Queen and Dieu et mon droit. And this song is just completely atheistic, as the chorus, There Is No God, reminds us. When did you realize there is no God?
Well, I come from a religious family, and I think one of the things that's important for me about this song is it's not supposed to be a kind of screw you, you're an idiot if you disagree with me kind of song. You know, it's not supposed to be kind of mean. It's supposed to be a joyous song. It's a happy tune, because the idea of a godless universe makes me happy. It makes me pleased and glad in a gospel-y kind of way.
Step out of the darkness and onto the streets. Forget about the farce, let's have a carnival feast. Raise up your lowered head and hear the liberation beat, because there never was no God, and there is no God. So clap your hands together, there is no God. No heaven and no hell, but there is no God. We're all in this.
Well, if people are still looking for salvation in your music, let's not forget your tune, I Still Believe. It points out that rock and roll has the power to save souls.
Yes, yeah, that's a song about, you know, I did a tour in China last year. I was doing some kind of illegal punk shows out there, and they've only kind of just figured out rock and roll over there, and they had this kind of incredible sort of naive burning passion, because they've only just figured out that if you play that chord and then that chord and then that chord and then play it really fast and then shout over the top of it, then everyone goes crazy. And there was something so refreshing about their passion for rock and roll that made me feel almost kind of like ashamed to be jaded about it sometimes. So I wanted to write a song to remind myself and other people that it's okay every now and again to just take stock for 5 minutes and go, you know what, rock and roll is an awesome thing and it's great that we have it in our lives.
Well, I Still Believe takes us out today. Frank Turner, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And I still believe in the saints. Yeah, in Jerry Lee and in Johnny and all the greats. In the sound that has the power to raise a temple.
Frank Turner. His new album, England Keep My Bones, comes out in June. By the way, go to theworld.org to watch a video of Turner performing this song. We've also posted a link to his blog. That's it for us this week. Eric Goldberg composed The World's theme music from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend.
After all, something so simple, something so small. Who'd have thought? After all, it's rock and roll.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Radio Boston. The World is supported in part by the National Science Foundation, where discoveries begin. Information at nsf.gov. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And by the PRI Program Fund, supporting informed risk-taking in public radio programming. PRI Program Fund contributors include the Ford Foundation and Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees.
PRI, Public Radio International.